Welcome to Unreal, a podcast about Irish history, stories, and tradition. Up the airy mountain and down the rushy glen, we dare not go a-hunting for fear of little men. The Donegal poet, William Allingham, wrote these lines in 1850 and set off a wave of fear and excitement about the little tricksters and fairy people who have haunted our folklore for centuries. Down in the hollows, hiding just out of sight, the wee folk are watching our every move. And despite their size, these little beings can bring about an incredible amount of destruction. But were the wee folk always thought of as so sinister? And is it possible that they could think of humans as being just as magical as we think of them? I'm Ruth Atkins, and this is Unreal. The tales of King Ubden and King Fergus, the little and large kings who met in Ulster, are some of the first references to the clever little beings that would eventually be called the leprechauns. Leprechauns, as we know them today, didn't become an established part of folklore about Ireland until the mid-19th century, when the Irish folklorist Thomas Crofton Croker wrote about them in the 1820s, most areas of Ireland had a different name for this trickster. There was the Cluricaun of County Cork, the Luricaun of Kerry, the Lurigadon of Tipperary, the Leprechaun of Leinster, and the Loggeryman of Ulster. The reason for this is simply down to how stories spread in oral tradition. If the person listening to the story misunderstands or mishears a phrase, then they'll repeat what they think they heard when they tell the story themselves. So, pretty soon, whole areas had their own title for the little fellow that they had picked up through misunderstandings along the way. And as well as having different titles, each community had distinctive ways of describing the leprechaun figure, the clothes he wore, and the ways he acted. The Cluricaun was said to come from Clubber Ceann, meaning merry head, which gave the fellow his fondness for drinking. It was said that Leprechaun came from La Brogan, or half a shoe, which led to him being depicted as a shoemaker, much like the elves in the Grimm's fairy stories. The leprechaun stories also had similarities with tales of Scottish brownies and Robin Goodfellow of England. When manuscripts first made mention of the little men, however, they simply referred to them as Lucarpon, little body. Lucarpons were said to be a race descended biblically from Noah's cursed son Ham, along with the Fomorian giants and an array of other monsters. However, some scholars now believe that even this phrase was a medieval misunderstanding, and that the real origin of the word may go all the way back to Roman times. In most of the famous stories, leprechauns had one purpose: guarding a store of riches that a person could take for themselves if they outsmarted them. Ireland does love tales of hidden treasure, unsurprising given just how much gold has been plundered and hidden in the times of monasteries. Some stories of leprechauns said that they were the guardians of these hidden gold stores around the countryside. Others, often told in towns, said that leprechauns had in their possession a little purse that would never be empty, no matter how many times you reached into it for a coin. if you could succeed in catching a leprechaun and not letting him out of your sight, untold wealth would be yours for the taking. But leprechauns never made it easy for you. The magical, never-empty purse could be switched for a normal one as quick as lightning. And as soon as you took your eye off him, the leprechaun would vanish, never to be found again. One story told of a Kerry man, Tim O'Donovan, who captured a leprechaun in his bog and made him reveal the location of his treasure. As he had no spade, Tim marked the spot, driving his stick into the ground and resting his hat on it so that he would know where to dig the next day. The following morning, Tim returned, spade in hand, but he got a nasty surprise. Everywhere he turned, for as far as the eye could see, there were hundreds and hundreds of hats, just like his, balanced on hundreds and hundreds of sticks, just like the one he had used to mark the ground. Try as he might, Tim couldn't tell which spot was the real one, and so he had to leave empty-handed, cursing the leprechaun, who of course was long gone. And of course, hiding gold wasn't the only mischief the wee folk could get up to. They were fairies, after all, and the fairies of old folklore could be pretty sinister little beings. William Allingham's poem of Little Men goes on in less well-known verses to talk about the much more frightening tricks the wee folk could play. They stole little Bridget for 7 years long. When she came down again, her friends were all gone. They have kept her ever since, deep within the lake, on a bed of flag leaves, watching till she wake. By the craggy hillside, through the mosses bare, they have planted thorn trees for pleasure here and there. If any man so daring could dig them up in spite, he shall find their sharpest thorns in his bed at night. Stories like these warned people against greed and carelessness, and against needlessly disturbing the landscape around them. The vengeance of fairies was not something you ever wanted to bring about. But like many things in life, it's all a matter of perspective. Perhaps when you're as small as a fairy or leprechaun, it's pretty scary to have your home or fort wrecked by a lumbering being so much bigger than you are. In other, earlier tales, the wee folk were said to believe themselves to be the largest people in the world, and thought of human folk with fear, as the strange, powerful giants who could attack their homes. The story of King Ogden, King Fergus, and the famous Ulster Porridge Pot was first written in 1517, based on an earlier 8th century story that was collected for some reason in a set of legal manuscripts. The story is a tale of two societies who fear each other, humans and lucre pawns, coming together at last in understanding. In it, we get to see the tale for once from the wee folk's eyes. It's a story that shows that the lucre pawn beings are much more complex than our folktales usually depict them, and that magic and wonder is really all in how you view things. King Fergus MacLeity of Ulster was ordering a great feast at his fort in Avon Vaca. But it happened that on that very day and hour, another king was preparing a banquet in another feasting hall in another kingdom. Ogden, king of the lucre pawns or wee folk of the land of Fay Lynn, was preparing a great assembly of his lords and princes, with their heir apparent, Beag son of Beg, and Queen Bebo and her maidens, and his strong man Glower, famous throughout the land, for he could knock down a thistle with just one stroke of his axe. King Ogden's guests feasted on great haunches of roast hares and ribs of field mice, and as the wine flowed, they toasted their king and his wonderful kingdom. Perhaps the wine went slightly to Ogden's head, for his heart began to swell with pride, and he soon stood up and called out to his company.
"Come now,"
he said.
"Have any of you ever seen a king more glorious and powerful than I?" "Never,"
they all cried.
"Or horses or warriors better than those who tonight are here in this hall?" "Never, O king,"
they said.
"Or a strong man, stronger than my strong man, the giant Glaur, who can knock down a thistle with just one stroke of his axe." "By our words,"
the waiting audience cried,
"we never have."
Ogden looked around smugly.
"Truly, anyone who could try to attack Faelin would find it a hard task indeed. So fierce and mighty are we."
The great cheer that went around the room was suddenly interrupted by a loud peal of laughter. It was the king's chief poet, Ashert. Ogden called on him to explain the reason for his mirth.
"I'm sorry, O king,"
said Ashert,
"but I know of a province in Ireland, just one man of whom would be enough to capture our kingdom. And the king who rules there would fit you and I and all the people in this great hall inside his porridge pot, with room to spare."
King Ogden was furious.
"Seize the poet, and vengeance be upon him for his bragging speech."
It's a pretty great opening to the tale, and not a bad reminder to the listener that just because we believe ourselves to be the biggest and most important people in our own little world doesn't mean that there aren't outside powers larger than we could ever even imagine. As he was being dragged away by the guards, the poet Ashert made a prophecy that terrible things would come as a result of his arrest. He swore that he would go to Ireland and bring back proof of this giant race. And so, King Ogden released him, and Ashert set off on the journey. At the gates of Avon Vaca, the King Fergus's guards were very surprised to encounter a tiny nobleman, dressed in an elegant silk tunic and scarlet cloak, and carrying a poet's rod of white bronze, barely the size of a needle. The gatekeeper ran to tell King Fergus. King Fergus actually already had a little person in his court, a man called A, who was a wise man of science and the chief poet of the palace. So Fergus asked whether the tiny visitor was smaller than his poet, A. "Oh yes," said the gatekeeper. "In fact, he could stand on the palm of A's hand, with room to spare." With laughter and wonder, the lords and ladies trooped out to see Ashert and carried him into the banquet hall. "Who are you?" King Fergus asked.
"I am Ashert, son of Beg, chief poet, bard and rhymer of the Lucra and Lupricon of Faelin."
Ashert soon charmed King Fergus and his noblemen with wondrous tales of the land of Faelin, and they piled gifts in front of him, which he refused. After 3 days and three nights, he was ready to leave. "I will go with you," said A, Fergus's poet. A was such a small man in the human world that he could lie on the chest of the other Ulster warriors. But by Ashert's side, he was a giant, and he wished to see this land filled with people even smaller than him. Ashert and A set off, and they soon reached the seashore, where a creature came towards them, skimming over the surface of the waves.
"Tell me what you see,"
asked Ashert. "A red-maned hare," answered A.
"That is King Ogden's horse,"
said Ashert. Away they sped, over the tops of the waves, until they reached Feylin. There, the wee folk who waited on the shore were filled with wonder and fear at the sight of A.
"Have you brought this giant with you to slay us?"
cried King Obdin.
"He is no giant," said a shirt, "but a learned man and poet from Ulster, and in all that realm he is the smallest man."
King Obdin, as you can imagine, was quite dismayed at the sight. Here at last was proof that Ishert, the poet, had been right. The whole kingdom of Feylin, which he had been so proud to rule over, was tiny in comparison to the other kingdoms of the world. And worse, he knew that now that Ishert had returned, the next person to have to venture to this fearsome land of Irish giants would be him. Ishert put a warrior's challenge to Obdin, daring him to go to Ulster and taste the king's famous royal porridge. So, reluctantly, Obdin and his wife, Queen Bebo, mounted their noble hare that night and set off for the human realm. They crept into King Fergus's palace early in the morning, when all the Ulstermen were still asleep in their beds, and they found the great cauldron of porridge that Ishert had told them of. They had never seen anything like it. The rim of the pot was so high that Obdin couldn't reach it from the ground, so he clambered up on his horse and pulled himself up to the brim. Then he reached his tiny arm forward to the silver ladle to try and take a taste. But just as his fingers were about to touch it, he slipped. Down he tumbled into the pot, and the porridge was so thick around him that he couldn't move hand or foot. There are lots of fairy tales about magical pots that make too much food, and swimming in porridge is actually a pretty common motif in folklore. But what's fascinating about this story is that this porridge pot, which seems so fantastical, so magical, to the tiny King Obdin and his wife, is in fact just ordinary human porridge, with nothing special about it. I guess it all depends on how you look at things. Poor King Obdin was in a pretty sorry state at this point, with the Ulster people on the point of waking. He tried to sing a tragic lament of his plight to his fair maiden, Queen Bebo, just as any chivalrous hero would do. But it's hard to seem romantic rather than ridiculous when you're a tiny man stuck in a pot of porridge.
"Oh Bebo, oh Bebo,"
sang Obdin.
"Morning is at hand, and fast in the doughy remnant sticks my leg. Flee away, oh fair-haired woman, oh woman with fair hair. If here thou stay, thou art but foolish, oh Bebo."
But Bebo was not going to abandon her husband so easily.
"Never say it,"
she answered.
"I will not leave your side till I see what turn things take for thee."
So, when the Ulstermen woke and came down for their breakfast a short while later, they found Obdin stuck fast in the pot of porridge and Queen Bebo sobbing at his side. Laughing in surprise, the men plucked Obdin out of the pot and carried him away to King Fergus. "You aren't the little fellow that was here before," said Fergus. "Who are you, wee man?"
"I am king over the Lucre folk," said Obdin. "And this woman is my wife and queen, Bebo."
Fearing fairy mischief, Fergus ordered Obdin to be taken away and guarded. But Obdin pleaded that he had never in his life broken his word. So Fergus relented. He would not let Obdin leave, but he gave him a fair chamber in the palace and allowed him to share his fairy knowledge with the court. Ubjin, despite his size, came to be a valued member of the palace for his unique perspective on the human world. Still, the wee folk of Feylin weren't going to let Ulster keep their king forever. Soon, they too arrived at Fergus's palace, 7 battalions strong, demanding that their king be released. "For what ransom?" asked Fergus.
"Every year, we will cover your fields with corn,"
answered the wee folk. But Fergus refused. So, the wee folk set about wreaking havoc through Ulster each night that Ubjin remained in captivity. They drained the milk from every cow in the province, dirtied the wells and the river mouths, and snipped the ears off every stalk of corn. Finally, when all their mischief brought no result, they threatened to shave the head of every man and woman in Ulster. "If you do that," said Fergus, "I will slay Ubjin." Hastily, Ubjin intervened. He called on his subjects to put right what they had spoiled, and then sent them away. But then, he went to Fergus and offered him a choice of treasures in exchange for his release. Ubjin had many treasures: a spear that could beat 100 warriors, a cloak that would always look new, a belt that would protect against illness, and a cauldron that could turn stones into meat. The little poet, A, too, had returned from his travels to Feylin, and he also told of the wonders to be found there. "Every door was made of gold," he said, "with pillars of crystal and columns of silver." A had heartily enjoyed his time as a giant. He spoke of his friend Ishert's pretty wife, so small that she could sleep in A's rounded glove. 17 maidens of the wee folk could sleep on his chest, and 4 men in his belt, and still more could creep into his beard without him noticing. Everywhere he went, the people of Feylin would call after him,
"Enormous A, oh very giant!"
"A wondrous adventure has befallen me," said A dreamily. Having heard these lists of treasures and wonders, King Fergus made his decision. He agreed that he would take King Ubjin's magical shoes, which allowed the wearer to travel under the lakes and seas. Having accepted his gift, Fergus told Ubjin that he was free to go. And there ends the part of the lucre pawns or wee folk in King Fergus's story. The lucre pawns are far less tricksy in this story than they become in the later tales I have told. The attacks that they make are done from desperation rather than malice, and King Ubjin is even more afraid of the Ulstermen than they are of him. It's a story of 2 very different kings learning of totally different worlds, and coming to treat each other with respect and share their wisdom. However, the gift that King Ubjin gave to Fergus did end up leading to King Fergus's death, indirectly. King Fergus used the shoes often to explore the underwater realms of Ireland. But one day, he went to Loch Rory, the one place where the lucre pawns had warned him never to go. There in Loch Rory, a terrible monster called a Murdris rose out of the water and attacked the king. The wounds left King Fergus crooked and scarred, with his mouth twisted round to the other side of his face. While Fergus rested, unaware of his changed appearance, his charioteer hurried back to the palace and warned everyone of what had happened. Quickly, the wise men of Ulster removed all the mirrors and glass from the house, and for 7 years afterwards, they made sure that no one would reveal to the king that he was no longer the handsome man he once was. But one day, a servant girl came to wash King Fergus's head. Thinking that she was being too slow, Fergus lashed out at her with his whip. And in response, the angry girl raised up the bowl of water and showed Fergus his disfigured reflection. Immediately, Fergus realized what must have happened, and he swore to kill the murderous monster once and for all. He ran to Loch Rory and charged at the beast. With his trusty sword, the Callant Bullag, Fergus hewed the monster to pieces, and he emerged from the blood-filled lake holding her head. But his own body had as many wounds as hers. And as he gasped out to the watching Ulstermen, "I am the survivor," he sank down to the ground and breathed his last. King Obdin and the Lugar Pawns didn't exactly cause Fergus's death. In fact, they tried to warn him of the dangers. Even in earlier tales where King Obdin isn't named, the worst thing the wee folk do is prophesy his death. But somehow, these medieval depictions of a race of good but tiny folk have been distorted and changed over time. Without the wee folk to tell us their side of the story, we settle into mishearings and misunderstandings that make us feel the most comfortable with our place in the world. Appearances and self-deception are a major theme of both halves of this tale. We see what we want to see, and none of us can trust ourselves or the people we love to give us the honest truth about who we are. And perhaps that's the true challenge of this tale. It makes us question whether we really know our role in the wider world. Are we as large and strong as we think we are? Or are there far more powerful kingdoms lurking just out of sight? We are giants to some, and tiny to others. And little men aren't necessarily to be feared. It's all in how you look at things. But in order to realize that, you have to be brave enough to look in the first place. Thanks for listening to this episode of Unreal. You can find links to the stories and sources for this episode in the show notes on my website, unrealpodcast.com. You can also find links to the music from today's episode. The tune you are listening to right now is The King of the Fairies by Alan Stivell, and I also used a version performed by the Dubliners earlier. I also recently updated my website with some tips and links for anyone who would like to start researching folklore themselves, so do take a look at that if you're interested. You can follow the show on Twitter or Facebook at UnrealPod for updates, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to the people who have been leaving ratings and reviews, it really helps to spread the word. I'll be back soon with another story to tell. And until then, gnairí an bóthar leat.